Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother, Brian Mary Deese. Welcome to another Class War Battlefield podcast segment. Last episode, I spoke about global warming. I'm trying desperately not to use the whole concept of climate change anymore, because climate change was it was created by scientists, essentially, if memory serves me correctly, it was created by scientists to appease the right-wing attack on global warming, on the idea of just global warming. So they created it, and I'm to the point where I'm tired of that. The world is warming, so it's global warming. But I've been thinking a lot about this idea recently because I love the environment. I love outdoors, and you can definitely see changes in the environment. I'm sitting right now in New York, where we just had a large snowstorm. There was a blizzard warning south and to the east of me, but we didn't have a blizzard warning up here, though we probably had 2 feet or more of snow over the course of 2 days. Now, granted, up here, that's actually not that much snow, but comparatively to 1993, we had the major blizzard that time. Over two days, we had about 40 inches, so we're still below what we had then, but nonetheless, there it is. I don't know if that storm is global warming, if it is a product of global warming. I don't know that. But what I do know is that prior to that storm, in what is usually, and when I say usually, I'm not talking about, 60% of the times. No, I'm talking about 85-90% of the time. February is the coldest month of the year up here where I live. We experienced 70 degree days, multiples. We experienced 60 degree days. Now, to be fair, sometimes, periodically, you get a 60 degree day in February. Sometimes, periodically, you get a week of 50s in February. Periodically. But last year, we also had, February was pretty cold last year, but the fact that we had 50s, 60s, and 70s in February, which is supposed to be the coldest month, is staggering to me. This comes on the heels of a year, last year, where we had a tremendously warm winter that didn't start really getting cold until the middle of February. Again, though, may not be global warming. The point of this section, though, is to kind of rebuff a little bit people who have been running around talking about, oh, well, you know, global warming obviously isn't real. There's a book that everyone should really read. Anyone who has not read this book, you should read it. I produced a Class War Battlefield podcast episode a couple of years ago, which had to do with global warming. And I used part of that book, a little section of that book, at the beginning of that podcast. And I spliced down a documentary on global dimming, which I remember watching that thing in, I think it was 2005 or 2006, and it threw me so much because that documentary deals with an aspect of global warming which most people don't they don't even know exists, let alone understand. Plus, I had the weird experience of being able to confirm what the man was talking about on that documentary, because the crux of the documentary is this guy had a theory that particles that were being released by planes, I think it was predominantly planes, was actually causing a global mass dimming effect over the country and the world. And when 9/11 happened, of course, all aviation activity was grounded. What does that mean then? Over the course of 2 or 3 days, all of those jet trails or whatever they call them were not there. And he said he went to work. He went to work tracking global temperature changes, well, actually United States temperature changes, without the planes being there. And what he found stunned him, because he had a theory. He said, well, look, those are definitely blocking out sunlight. But he thought that it only impacted the temperature by a small amount. What he found was in those 2 or 3 days, it was the temperature range deviated dramatically from the historical average temperature, way more than what he thought would have happened. Now, why I say I had the strange coincidence of being able to verify what he was, what he said, was because I'm a country boy. I grew up in the country. I spent a lot of time outside playing football, playing baseball, playing whatever. That's what I did. And because of this, once you're out in the country a lot, you kind of get a feel for the weather. And so I had the ability, like I think some country people do, of being able to look at the sky and say, huh, yeah, the sun's shining, but we're about to get rain. And then an hour later, we got rain. Well, I also loved the sun and noticing, you know, when the sun was bright, when it wasn't, how, you know, it was shining. That was just something that I did because I loved the sun. It just so happened that I think it was September 12th. Maybe it was September, yeah, it was September 12th of 2001. I was outside with my brother playing football, playing catch. And my brother looks at me and says, is it me? And I go, what, the sun is brighter, isn't it? And he goes, yeah, I thought it was just me. I go, yeah. I've been thinking that all day. The sun is definitely brighter. It was noticeable. And we had a dramatically warm winter that year. Very warm. Unusually warm. It was one of the first Thanksgivings that I remember without a lot of snow. In fact, I think it was in the 50s. Might have even been up to 60 that day. We had warm weather through February, actually.
And we had strange weather, which kind of mirrored last year. So, you know, go and re-listen to that if you really want to. It's at radioforall.net if you really want to, you know, check that out. But get the book. The book is fantastic. It looks at global warming deniers and who's funding them, and takes their points and just obliterates them with science. Obliterates them. I'm not even talking it treats them with kid gloves. I'm talking it takes them, it grinds them up, and feeds them to the people who are spouting them. That's how good, that's how well of a job they do. Now, people who happen to believe this nonsense that global warming is not being initiated by mankind, they use a couple of excuses. And one of the most blatant really is about economics. Oh, well, if this is all meant to interrupt the economic prosperity of America, as if the economic prosperity of America has been anything but interrupted. Please. Economic prosperity of America has been sliding for the last 40 years. I'll say 40. I'll say give it to the 70s. So that's absolute ludicrous. But let's appease the children for a minute and say that they're right. All right. What I say to them, and yes, I do mean children. Children act like that. Adults do not act like that. You face the reality of what's in front of you. When you have the inability, when you are incapable of facing that reality, that is immaturity. When you make excuses to cover up that reality because it is uncomfortable, that is psychological trauma. It is a psychosis problem. And that essentially makes you, it doesn't make you a big child, but you tend to act a little bit more childish in that reasoning, because you want simple fixes to complex answers. You don't build a house by putting up two external walls, a small, maybe some plywood for a roof, and cutting a little bit of a door out of one of the walls. You're going to look and you're going to say, well, wait a minute, that ain't no house. That ain't got four walls. That ain't got a roof. That ain't got wiring. That ain't got this. You build a house with complexity. There's complexity to it. That means, if you want to renovate that house, there's going to have to be a complex solution. Now, you may not understand that solution, but you go and you get somebody who will. That's called usually an architect, an electrician, a plumber, somebody who understands the entire infrastructure of your house. This is the same thing with the globe. The fact that these people want to act like they know better because they have economics on the brain, instead of realizing that there's other people who actually do this for a living and care about it, and thus they may know a little bit more than you, and you might want to defer to them. That's childish. That is absolutely childish. But I really have one answer to these people. One. And I've said it to multiple conservatives, and they have nothing when you say it to them. The simple response to them is, okay, so it's going to hurt the economy. Let's look at this then from the standpoint of impact. You say that you don't believe it because you think it's basically an economic ploy. So, if you're right, all right, what's the consequence? You're going to create millions of new jobs in a burgeoning industry which is happening everywhere else in the world but here. We're the only country that is not pouring massive amounts of investment into this economic boondoggle, which Germany is threatening to crack within the next 10 years. And if they crack it, that means, as they put it, they are going to be able to sell that technology to the world for the next 100 years instead of us. So, if you're right, what's going to happen? We're just going to create more jobs in an industry that's already going to be booming anyway. If you're wrong, we're not only going to miss out on creating those jobs, but the environment's going to suffer. It's going to make life harder. We're going to experience failure crops, or crop failures. We're going to experience the drying up of reservoirs where people get water from. This is going to cause internal migration patterns, which are going to negatively impact certain states where the problem isn't as dramatic. This then is going to put an economic strain on communities which cannot bear to have that strain placed upon them, because guess what? They're relying on jobs from old industries which are now dying out because they're no longer needed. So in 10, 15 years, when we should have a very vibrant and functioning green decentralized economic culture in this country, we have a very centric oil and gas culture, which we should see from the UK, which had a coal-centric economic plan in the late 1800s, early 1900s. It ain't working. It ain't working. They never recovered from that. They should have went into oil. They stayed with coal. Boom. They lost their empire. The United States now is making the same mistake. But if you're correct, again, this is what's going to happen. Not possible. This is what's going to happen. If I'm correct, not only do we help the environment and start to clean up the environment, which, by the way, in and of itself will create hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of new jobs. Imagine if we had a massive forest restoration program all throughout the country. We had a massive relocation program where we took communities which were in very unsafe areas and we moved them, or areas where it would be vital to the environmental health. We moved them, we relocated them to areas where, I don't know, maybe the economy wasn't doing so well, but we revitalized those economies with green jobs, with jobs of forest restoration, with jobs of taking care of the environment, and guess what? That's a whole new industry by itself. We revitalize those things. We're going to have to do it at the government level first, and then you put it into private hands once when it proves that it's viable. And if it's not viable, then we got to start talking about collective maneuvers, which would take it out of the realm of government, but put it into public hands, Commonwealth hands, which stretch throughout the state. Then we got to start talking about cooperatives. Then you're going to also create definitely millions, maybe tens of millions of new jobs, green jobs, as you not only look to green technologies, but you also start looking to revitalizing renewables. Now, we often talk about renewable energies, but we do not talk about renewables by themselves. Think about this, ladies and gentlemen. Think about this very, very, very much. We have the technology to, first and foremost, we have the technology, and this is something that should definitely be done. We should be recycling as much as possible. And when I say as much as possible, we should have huge recycling plants throughout this country employing tens of thousands of people. We shouldn't be wasting much of nothing. That's a program which we should be implementing. That'll put at least a million people to work, maybe more. Now, renewables. We have the technology now to create plastic from not only hemp, but from rice. I've seen, don't quote me on it, I've seen, I think actually this is true. We have technology to take grass. I mean, grass that you plant into the, that you want to get rid of anyway, and make paper and other things from that. We can make plastics. We can make rubber synthetics from plants. All of this stuff. We can even make clear glass, clear plastic with this stuff. We can do this with renewables, and it's biodegradable. Biodegradable. And a lot of it, you plant it, it helps to revitalize the soil. You move it after 3 or 4 years, the soil nutrients are back. Now you plant new plants, boom, let it fly. We have that technology. So this then would open up the door for millions of new jobs. When I'm saying millions, I'm not talking about 2 or 3 or 4 or 5. I'm talking about an economy which shifts dramatically that way over the next 10 years. You can be talking about, I'd wager, because this is, you need to do most of this locally. You have to do most of this locally. So then this is going to put people to work in farms, in greenhouses, in factories that are going to have to process this stuff. I think nationwide you can talk with this 10 million plus jobs. And then you got service industries, because people need food. People are going to want food. People are going to have to install the green technology in their houses. You're going to have manufacturers which are going to have to replace some of their equipment, and then that means you're going to have people build that equipment. We talked about this the last time. All of these things generate jobs. All of these things generate jobs. And when I look at a person who is telling me that, you know, environmentalism is just an economic trap, and I lay this out to them, well, how do you know all this? You got to be able to read the signs. You got to be able to read the signs. That's basically it. Well, then you're just going off of nothing. No, I'm going off of statistics. We did some of this back in World War II. We were able to put millions of people to work building stuff that the government needed and that the country needed. Now, we need a green technology revolution. Guess what? We can put millions of people to work doing that. Since private industry is unwilling to go that route, that means we have to go that route. And how we go that route is through government. People tend to not like it, but ultimately, they have nothing to say about this because they can't tell me. When I look at them and say, well, you explain to me the economic value of staying with the environment isn't, you know, being polluted by mankind. Explain to me the economic value based in that. Oh, well, people won't lose their jobs for oil and coal, and I'd stop them right there. People are already losing their jobs for coal because we are shutting down coal plants. Not because of Obama, not because of the government, but because the United States doesn't produce as much coal as it once did. We are like Britain in that aspect. We got to get off the fact, or excuse me, we got to get off of the misconceived notion that coal somehow is going to rush back and we're going to be able to capitalize on it. Now, because coal is in higher demand, but there is little left of it here. I mean, there is still some great veins of coal and what have you, especially up north. But now because that's happening, they're going to Shell, and they're doing Shell gas, which, if you remember Jimmy Carter's speech, he actually mentioned, which people often overlook, but he did mention that. And that is even worse for the environment. This is why you have Oklahoma having freaking earthquakes when they never used to, or at least periodically they would. These are larger earthquakes, though. So, that's not an argument. we're not going to get rid of oil overnight, so people are still going to be employed within the oil industry probably for the next 20 or so years. But as peak oil descends downward now, because that's where we're at, that's the trend we're at now, as that happens, we need to be moving away from that. And since most people don't know what peak oil is, if they care, and if it's not just I'm gonna hold fast to my team, if they care, they say, wait a minute, what's peak oil? And then you explain to them the whole idea of what is it, the Hubbard Bell, the idea of producing ever greater amounts of oil, it peaks, and then going downwards. You tell them that there was a conference on that put together by some of the leading oil producers in the world, including oil consulting firms, in, was it 2013? 2012? And they said it. They believe that between 2015 and pretty much now, they think that we've hit peak oil and now it's just, we're going downwards now. But if that's, again, if they're open and if they're serious about it, but then you also move over and you say, look, people aren't going to be put out of work from the oil industry. What we're doing is we're creating new jobs. We're creating new jobs for folks who don't have jobs. And we are giving greater autonomy to the community, which supposedly that's what conservatives like, right? I told this to one conservative, and he goes, how is that going to be giving greater autonomy to, you know, the community when the government's going to be the one dictating? I said, see, that's, you get away from the whole dictating. Well, that's what they do. No, first, calm down. Secondly, the government in the 1930s gave out tremendous amounts of money to build infrastructure all throughout this world, or all throughout this country. People needed jobs. People didn't care. They weren't talking about dictating nothing. They were talking about, oh crap, I can feed my family now. Well, private industry has proven that they are unwilling to do it. So, how you empower the community? Because if you have private industry, private industry isn't about empowering no community. None. They have never went to a community and said, we are giving you more power, or we're going to give you power over us. If you can name to me a company that did that, I'll shut up right now. They have nobody. That's when you continue. How this empowers communities is because after the green economy is set up, it is, by its very nature, decentralized. You can't dictate it from a Washington office. It is more naturally occurring. All you need then is the structure economically at the local and the state level. Which, by the way, then all federal government does is just make sure the agreed upon rules are being played by everybody. Everyone's going by them. Then they just hands off. You guys, you know, we'll tweak every now and then to make sure it stays balanced. And that's what it would do. Well, how do you know that? How do I know it? Because that's what they do for Medicare. And old folks love Medicare. Republicans try to take away Medicare, and old folks will get up out of their grave and riot. That's what they do for Medicare. That's a boondoggle, by the way, for the industries that get to suckle off that teat. And most conservatives can't mess with you on that. They can't mess with you on it because it is a reality. Even they know that their grandparents, their great-grandparents, or whoever, who are on Medicare, they know that they would kill somebody if they tried coming and taking that away from them. And so once you get them to see that, yeah, this is same thing, nothing new, they tend to calm down, and they let the hysterics go. Because the reality is, ultimately, if you really are supposedly for creating jobs, you have to admit a couple of things, especially when it comes to environmentalism. Private industry sucks. Their environmental record sucks. The only reason why you needed the EPA in the first place was because, guess what? The free market wasn't doing crap about the environmental problems being created by the free market. That's why you needed the EPA. They were still doing the crap which they had been doing since the invention of capitalism, and basically since the time when capitalism and industrialization started taking hold in America, which was, screw the environment if we can make money, and by the way, screw the people if we are even poisoning them. We don't care about that. We just want to make money. So then the EPA was required. The EPA was required because they proved themselves incapable of doing the simple task of caring for the planet, which they need, by the way, to survive. Once you get them to understand that, sometimes it's difficult, then they tend to back off and say, well, okay, well, can't argue with that. Can't argue with that. Now, though, and this is the great thing about revisionism, and I love this, I'm starting to hear, you know, people like Stefan Malinex and his little brood of friends talk about liberal revisionists, or excuse me, not liberal revisionists. They're talking about revisionism as essential and as a good thing. Like, we go in and we revise history because we find all these little tidbits of information which you know, liberal academics like to leave out so they can, you know, fill their narratives. And this is like smoking crack and then saying that you are on Jenny Craig. It's just not true. I've listened to Mr. Malinex, which is one of these right-winged idiots who's not been dinged and needs to be dinged. He makes decent points periodically, but the majority of his asinine assertions come from the idea that corporations needs to basically rule the world. And when you can talk about revisionism, which has always been seen as a negative, not a positive, but a negative, and you tell me that it is positive because you're somehow uncovering truth, and by the way, then asperging conspiracy researchers who actually are finding amazing details to fill in the holes of, oh, well, why did this happen? Oh, now we understand this. Why did that happen? Oh, now we understand that. Revisionism isn't about that. Revisionism is taking what is known to have been the case and overturning it by saying those facts aren't as important as these sub-facts in this sub-thought pattern which was underneath and trying to push up. But that sub-thought pattern wasn't real, wasn't based on real reality or realistic assertions. So what we have now is a revisionist mindset where, and this is something that I've ran up against, and it's frustrated me immensely, where you assert, okay, the reason why the EPA came into existence is because corporations weren't taking care of the environment. Revisionists come in and say, well, that wasn't necessarily true. What really happened was liberals got beside themselves about something. And if you look back to this conservative newspaper from 1969, this is what it was about. And it wasn't. The conservatives were smoking too much hippie weed and doing too much blow, and they wrote these papers which weren't, again, based on freaking reality. But yet the revisionists say, if it's a newspaper, then it must be true, when it's not. I'm having a little bit of fun, but it's not. And I've I recently ran up against this on another topic, which was a person brought up to me conservatism and its evolution. And God, what did they tell me? They told me something that was completely the opposite of the of who conservatives were. Oh, they tried to equate Republicans as always being conservatives, and I was like, the Republicans have not always been conservatives. In fact, up until 1964, they were not conservatives. The Republicans were considered moderate. Eisenhower was a moderate. He was not a conservative. You can look at his platform. He was not a conservative. There was a shift when the Democrats started supporting the civil rights bills in the early 60s. A lot of the Democratic conservatives went to the Republicans. The person looked at me and said, that is not, see, that's not true. That's not true. That never happened. Said that was, in fact, it did happen. That was how Goldwater became their standard bearer. Goldwater, though, even though he was somewhat of a racist, he wasn't an overt conservative. He just capitalized on the moment. Got beat for it, but what can you say? The Republican Party, as I told them, was really built from that onslaught of new conservative Democrats who seen the Democrats as going too far to appease black voters. The person told me that that just never happened. It did happen, but revisionism has taken that out, so they don't know. Or they really honestly believe it just never happened that way. So while, yes, I've definitely given some points to this, I do see the challenges associated with trying to spread the truth. Spreading the truth is difficult in an era where facts are under attack every day. Now, if you remember an early, I think it was a, it was a late 2016 episode, I talked about how the CIA pretty much set all this up because they, look, they have, and they admitted this in the 70s, they have individuals working on the staff of every major newspaper across the country, and they're always planting false information. In fact, we've seen a lot of false information over the last 15 years from the CIA, 9/11 being one of them. But so many people don't like to hear that, but it's the reality. There is a lot of information that they put out that is false. And even though nobody wants to say it, the CIA really did set up this environment. They went between them and the media in the 1970s, went to work to create a technosphere in this world, in this country, a media sphere, really, an entertainment sphere, where radicalism would be drained from the consciousness of people, where the idea of workers' rights would be drained from the consciousness of the people, where the ideas associated with socialism, really, I guess, would be drained from the mindset and the consciousness of the people, where the people would be made to be children, as John Taylor Gatto asserts. They went to work to create that environment, and to create, and man, did they do it quickly, too, to create a business, a corporate-friendly atmosphere. And why I say they did it very quickly was because by the mid-80s, you had a very corporate-friendly population. Very corporate-friendly. And it was from this created, I don't even know what to call it, It was from this created misdirection, misleading entertainment technosphere that a major distrust in the media rose up. And truthfully, that really led to people... I like to think that 2000, the presidential election of 2000, and the mishaps surrounding the Iraq War really did end the media's ability, the media's relationship with the public. People just did not trust them. Did not trust them. And with Occupy Wall Street, the same thing happened. I also would say that Fox News hasn't helped, especially when it came to the Tea Party. Oh, the news media isn't going to give the Tea Party any good coverage. The news media gave the Tea Party a lot of coverage. Too much, sometimes. And they ignored Occupy Wall Street for a long time. Until they couldn't anymore. Until the internet blew up and said, yeah, the hell with you. We care about this. The same thing happened with Trayvon Martin. The media does not have a good track record. And part of it, like I said, I think the CIA started that track record. But it's only increased after the media has had one fail after another. So, the predicament which we are in with facts is rooted in that. And even though we'd like to think that it's going to... it's going to get better. I really don't think it's going to get better, but we still have to try, and that's the burden of being conscious. Now, it's not a burden of being liberal, because liberal does not mean that you are conscious, or that you, well, even that you have a conscience. I know some liberals that, you know, liberals and progressives, and I'm like, yeah, you're just doing it to do it. But to be conscious, not conscience, but conscious, is a burden of spreading truth. That's what it's about. And ultimately, that's all we have in times like this. I have a couple of segments to play. I know I started off saying that this was a segment. This is not a segment, apparently. It was supposed to be, but lo and behold, it turned into an episode. So, yeah, I'll play the segments and then come back and end the show. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your brother, Vladimir Deese. Welcome to another Class War Battlefield podcast episode segment. You know, in the last episode, I actually talked briefly about a concept and idea that I'm going to talk about here, which is that I truthfully believe Donald Trump is a bit of karma. I truthfully believe Donald Trump is a bit of karma. I have several right-winged Christian friends who are very rabidly Republican. And they have been talking and spewing their ideological nonsense for years. And I've been really kind and calm and showing them facts, showing them information. Look, this is the reality. You may not like the reality, but this is the reality. And none of them wanted to listen. None of them. Absolutely none of them. And, you know, their concept of everything, especially I remember when the GOP took back the House in 2010, that was God-inspired. When the GOP gained more seats in 2014, that was God-inspired. God did the greatest work because the Democrats were so nasty and horrible. And now with Donald Trump, this is God's work. And so, you know something? I started thinking about this. And I know most socialists, I do count myself now back in that camp. I'm kind of sorry that I left it. I was talking, if you go back to 2012 episodes, just radioforall.net. If you go back and you check some of the first episodes I uploaded there, you will see I was talking about socialism for a long time. I let a brother named Michael Rupert, who passed away, talk me out of it. Oh, socialism ain't going to help us. Socialism is going to help us. that's the key. I don't care what Europeans did with it X amount of years ago. That's them folks. They messed it up. Doesn't mean that it still actually has viable solutions and answers and that it does actually work. It does. It's just you got to actually operate it within democratic principles. But that's another thing. I'm starting to really get to the point where I agree with my friends. I agree with them. When they tell me, oh, Donald Trump's election was God's, you know, greatest gift, or it was God's work, you know? Yeah, you're right. I believe it was God's work. Why? Because it's karma. It's karma. For 30 plus years, this goes back to what Jeremiah Wright was talking about, not God bless America, God damn America. But for 30 plus years, God was swooping down and saving you from yourselves. Every time when he'd loosen the reins, one of you, you'd get together and you'd put in another Republican or you'd put in another conservative. And so he'd tighten the reins again, bring somebody reasonable in there to do some decent work. And then he'd loosen the reins again and boom, here comes another Republican, here comes another conservative. And things would get worse and then tighten the belt again. But things were not getting better. And so finally God said, all right, okay, all right, you want it, have it. And here comes Mr. Trump. Boom. Boom. And, you know, I believed this, but I'm starting to believe it even more. And the reason why I'm starting to believe it even more is because I was listening to the broadcast, and he recounted this story of this guy in North Carolina, an evangelical, 59 years old, if memory serves me correctly. And he had voted Republican for 3 decades. And he made a statement. He says, look, most people like him, evangelical Republican types, don't realize that all you need is to lose one job and your goose is cooked. Obamacare literally saved my life. 59 years old. He's been voting Republican for over 3 decades. That means back into his 20s, he was voting against universal health care. He was voting against a social welfare state. Look up the word welfare. Don't get caught up in the entitlement concept. You want to talk about entitlement, look at the stuff that rich people get from the government. You want to talk entitlement. But he was voting against structures and investments that would have benefited his children, if he had any. Don't know if he does. And benefited him in the long run. Building the social fabric would have benefited him in the long run. We could have been building community hospitals, community fitness and wellness centers, community daycares, and a whole social welfare system for the last 30 plus years that he has been voting against that. We could have been doing that. And then suddenly, he's 59, and by the way, newsflash, you're now in your late 50s, guess what? Companies won't tell you this, but they are going to age discriminate against you now because there's a whole bunch of young workers who need jobs. So we could have actually been building up industries which could have kept young and older workers occupied at the same time, but because we weren't building a social welfare society or even the social fabric, guess what? We don't have that. So they're going to discriminate against you because you are older, you cost more for them to keep on the workforce, and they want to bring in younger workers. So even if they weren't going to discriminate against you, they need to bring in people who have the new skills that they now require. I know, it's wrong, they shouldn't discriminate against you, but guess what? Part of that is also karma. Part of that's also karma. You spent 30 years discriminating against a whole bunch of people who you wanted to call lazy and this and that and that and this, and now you're getting your medication at a time when you are the most vulnerable and you can least afford it, just like the people who you were shatting on. And suddenly the light goes off. Holy crap, I might need this stuff someday. And this is the problem. This is the problem, which is why I'm starting to truthfully believe and accept the fact that Donald Trump is just karma. He's just karma. These people do not understand that not everybody has what they have. And they seem to be incapable of appreciating the fact that hard times do happen. Poverty does exist, so wealth and richness can exist elsewhere. They seem to have an issue with appreciating the fact that, yes, to which much is given, which is funny, this guy's an evangelical, he's a Christian, and for some reason, he missed that part in the Bible, which much is given, much is expected. Actually, I don't even know if that's in the Bible, but my God, it's a universal principle, for God's sakes. If you don't know it and you a Christian, you a hell of a dumbass Christian. And I ain't even apologetic about that. You are. If you don't know that and you don't live by it, then you are a dumbass Christian. Period. Get mad about it if you want, then go talk to God about it, because God will tell you. And then get pissed off at him and see what happens to you. This is karma, pure and simple. As I said in the last episode, I told friends of mine, I go, look, Donald Trump is the president that America kind of deserves. And even though it still, like, blew my mind away once when he won, I think he's proving once and for all that, yes, that is a correct statement. He is an American president. He is America embodied in flesh. Everything that these supposedly self-made, egotistical conservatives wanted, they're now getting and they're realizing, holy crap, there's prices to all of this. And the comfort that I have enjoyed is built on the stuff which I've been railing against. Karma. I hope their medicine tastes good. I'll see you on the other side. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother, Vladimir Deese. Welcome to another Class War Battlefield Podcast segment. I'll tell you, the more I listen to a lot of the left, and I listen to a number of really good left podcasts, one of which has kind of always somewhat been a favorite of mine, because he does amazing work, is Brad Friedman at the Brad Blog. One of the most detailed, news-worthy podcasts that you can ever listen to. And very, very relevant to the day, so you'll learn a lot for that day, for that week. by listening to his podcast. But the one thing that I noticed with a lot of left podcasts, and going forward, this has to really be kept in the back of one's mind, because, as I've often said, I really don't see much difference being a black man between conservatism and liberalism. Liberalism talks a good game, but doesn't show up to play. Conservatism talks a hell of a game and comes out and plays. And liberalism has shown no ability, none, to actually push that conservative game back without radicals pushing them forward. If it was not for radicals, you would have never had the New Deal. If it wasn't for radicals, you would have never had to push towards universal health care, which led to Medicare, which led to Medicaid, which led to housing projects, not projects in the inner cities and black communities, because, you know, those took the place of real black communities. These were just created as basic social laboratories for government agencies. No. The GI Bill and what have you, all of that really came from the work of radicals. The move, the labor wins during the 1930s and 1940s, those came from radicals. Liberals implemented some of those policies, but they took them all from radicals. Liberals had nothing in the 20s to abate the Wall Street crony push, which led to the Great Depression. They had nothing. They could do nothing. It was only when radicals started standing up and gaining a lot of power and momentum that liberals were able to do anything, because then conservatives stopped beating them in the face and said, oh, if we don't get serious about major reforms, which I will give liberals some credit, they were talking about some of these reforms before they were implemented, but not necessarily to the extent that the radicals were talking about. But conservatives said, if we don't get serious about putting some of these reforms on, we're going to lose the country, because the radicals, which included communists, socialists, social welfare workers, social workers, anarchists, which are not what most people think they are, and a host of others, but they said, hey, if we don't get serious about this, we're going to lose it all, because our ineptitude basically has empowered these people who know that we're screwing them. And then the left, the liberal, which is really centralists, were able to move in and pass some reforms. Now, this is not to say that they're useless. It's just, I think Chris Hedges really has it correct. They only are empowered when things get that bad. Other than that, they're just always there to speak about consciousness, but they really don't do anything about it. And the last 50 years is a really good example of that. They have had their clock cleaned by conservatives. Cleaned. Completely cleaned. Can't do nothing about it. Progressives, same thing. Can't do nothing about it. The conservatives owned you. So here's the thing. Listening to a lot of left media, they don't seem to understand. They are a predominantly oppositional force. Meaning what exactly? They're not at their best when they're not able to oppose somebody. The greatest example of this, and I remember this, man, do I remember this, was when Barack Obama came into office, many left individuals gave him, they gave him maybe 4 or 5 months grace period before it was, oh, Obama's going back on his word. Oh, Obama's not really left. Oh, Obama's not really this. Of course, if you had paid attention to him throughout the election, you would have realized he was centrist or worse. But instead of doing exactly what Obama told them to do, which was get your butt out there, get organized, and make me do the things that you want me to do, like they're now doing with Mr. Trump, they sat back and complained. Now, this I don't want to give people, you know, the... I don't want to give people the appearance that I'm saying that they didn't do anything, because some people did do stuff. And indeed, I think the country was kind of in such a state of euphoria to get away from George W. Bush, that they that people leaned far too heavily on the possibility that Obama would become radical because he was half black, and they didn't take into account how Barack Obama grew up. He didn't know Barack Obama. I love him to death, but God, the guy's not black. He's half black. He's more white than he is black, which is something that liberals and leftists have never really understood, the idea that color and culture make a significant impact in a person's life. When you are a half black, half white man growing up in an environment where you really don't get treated that differently. I think, you know, I don't want to say he didn't have any experiences, but he was mommy's little accident, and, you know, I've seen how a lot of individuals who, you know, 30, 40 years ago would have been quick to say nigger this and nigger that, but now their children have half black children, and they love those little nigglets. Love them. Love them to death. Because they're theirs. They're theirs. And so, they didn't understand that, yeah, that whole projection of him looking black doesn't mean that he's going to be radical like he is black. No. If you wanted somebody like that, you should have selected Jesse Jackson, who ironically has the same kind of skin color as Barack Obama. As if black leadership can't find really good black leadership. They always got to have some whiteness in them. Anyway, they gave him about 4 months. They gave the Congress a little bit longer, but they gave him about 4 months. And that's because, again, it's just the oppositional. And to accept that, and then to work from that standpoint to craft a constructive agenda would be helpful to you and everyone who you're advocating for. It would be dramatically and tremendously helpful. But, you know, you got to first admit where you're at before you could do that. And I don't necessarily see that happening, but that's why I wanted to put this segment in here, because, you know, as things do progress forward, I do see some individuals putting together an agenda to possibly start a real third party or a coalition of third and fourth parties. And I don't want them to get into that race with a misconception of the mass psyche, which should be implemented and should be working for their benefit. Because if they are a predominantly oppositional group, and the oppositional aspect of their group is dominant, and if they run into a situation where now they have nothing to oppose overtly, then that could actually cause internal power structure or an internal conflict, which causes the structure to become weakened. So, you know, you got to understand all of this. If you don't, then it can blow up in your face. All right, thank you for listening. I'll see you on the other side. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother Vimer Deese. Welcome to another Class War Battlefield podcast segment. I didn't actually expect to do more intuities for this episode, so this is actually the third one, but I wanted to include it very quickly, very briefly, because I had a question by somebody on social media, and I wanted to answer it. The question was, why do I insist on continuously saying specific things? Specifically, they wanted to know about why I keep saying that black people were afflicted by these things for decades, and that many people escaped solving them because they weren't dark-skinned, particularly with Hispanics, particularly with lighter-skinned Arabs, particularly just with white folks in general. And the reason why I continuously say this isn't because I like to rub it in. Some people may get off on saying, well, yeah, you obviously like rubbing it in. That's why you say it. That's not why I say it. Why I say it, pure and simple, is one, because hearing it once is not enough to make it sink in. You must not even hear it twice or three times or four times. You must hear it enough so to the point where you are sick of it. That's the first time you really hear it. That's one. The second reason I mention it is because many people on the left, white left, Hispanic left, which I don't hear many of them. I hear more right-wing Hispanics than left-wing Hispanics. But many of them are, even Muslims, I hear a lot. I hear a lot of Jews right now talking about anti-Semitism, which to me is partly a joke, because anti-Semitism, the problem that it is nothing compared to the nightmare most black people live in this country. And the majority of Jews don't want to do anything about that, but they want to talk about anti-Semitism. And don't give me a list of people who are doing great work with somewhat sort of possibly solving the issues in the black community. I don't want to hear about tokens. I don't want to hear about tokens. I want to hear about detailed solving of the issues that black people have, period. This is why I keep saying it. For too long, people have nursed and nourished their own egos on the backs of black people. When they started feeling bad for what they had because they knew they didn't have it righteously, they'd go in and they'd do some work in black communities. And they'd say, oh, look at these poor souls. I could be like them. I could be so much, you know, I could be so much worse. To hell with you. Don't come in here and make yourself feel better about the fact that you are not getting your livelihood righteously by coming in and petting yourself while helping these poor animals these black folks who just can't get it together. No. The reason black people are in the state that they are in is because people like you found it necessary to enable a military police state to patrol our communities, to abuse our people, to pour drugs into our communities, among other things, which entertainment is a great example of a drug that is poured into our community every day, and it is not owned predominantly by black people, but it is eaten up by black people. It is Jim Crow entertainment. It does nothing to build actual character, but it destroys the mentality of black folks. But that is why I say it constantly. It's not because I'm angry, even though I am angry, because now that all of you are starting to go through this, now you want to fix it, but you don't want to still get to the root. It's amazing to me, because none of you want to still get to the root. It's about Hispanics being mistreated. It's about Muslims being mistreated, which, by the way, the largest population of Muslims in this country are black. But you'd never know it, because all they want to talk about is Arabs, who are honorary white people, just like most Hispanics. They are honorary white people, because they are, to quote another person, a radical from 50, 60 years ago, they consider most Latinos, they're niggas. They'll do the work that black people once did before black people started straightening up their back and saying, we ain't gonna take that abuse. You treat us with respect. You pay us well. And then we'll have no problem doing these jobs. White people said, to hell with you. We're going to go over here and get these Mexicans. These Mexicans believe in doing some work, which is funny, because if you read their literature from the 1800s, before they annexed half of Mexico, that ain't what they were saying about them niggas down in Mexico. Because you was black then, and you were niggas. And if the South had their way, they wanted to annex all of Mexico and turn it into plantations. You would have been just like the other niggas from Africa then. You would have absolutely been lazy. And you would have been whipped and whipped and whipped and whipped doing the work that they wanted you to do. And you still would have been lazy. But you ain't know nothing about that, do you? That's why I keep talking about it. Because too many of you non-white folks, and I ain't talking about the Jews now because y'all are white. You don't like to think of yourself as white, but y'all white. But too many of you non-white folks, you like to ignore the fact that you have benefited over the last 30, 40 years off of the fact that the state was going after black folks. And many of you snickered and snarled at black people and said, well, if them lazy people will just get their minds right, then the country would be fine. You fools. You fools. If the numbers are correct, 35% of Hispanics voted for Donald Trump. And now you want to cry? 35% of Asians voted for Donald Trump, if the numbers are to be believed. And now you want to talk about immigration problems? Oh, man. I ain't seen the numbers for Arabs. I'm hoping it ain't that high. I'm really hoping it ain't that high, because seriously, you know, there's something called karma. There's something called karma. I was listening to the broadcast. I listen to that almost every day. And he played this clip of this woman who Van Jones was interviewing for his little show on CNN. And this woman was lamenting how Donald Trump was going to be cutting community block grants, which were going to many people in the forms of meals from Meals on Wheels. And this woman says in this little clip, she says, you know, I used to kind of snicker and laugh at grandmothers. I don't know if she meant the idea of grandmothers. I'm hoping she meant the idea of grandmothers eating dog food. Now, this woman, 70, 80 years old, she used to snicker and laugh at that. So that meant 50 years ago, let's say she's 85, so 50 years ago, she's in her 30s. 50 years ago would have been in the 60s. So she's snickering and laughing at that whole notion of the fact that, what, 30 years before that, grandmothers were eating dog food to stay alive. So she's snickering and laughing at that. And now, 50 years later, what's that old thing? The sins of the father will be visited on the son? Well, now I guess maybe God was like, yo, this ain't working. They ain't learning. So, boom, visited upon you. 50 years later, now, that snickering and all that, now that's her. Now that's all, that's her. Imagine the type of children this woman, she created. Imagine the type of children that she raised with that type of an attitude. And you're wondering why things are the way they are? When you do not have compassion for people, because you think that it is some kind of a radical plot against the ability to be self-sustaining in a system which is not designed for self-sustaining people. A system that is designed to kill social mobility. I'm not talking about up the ladder, ladies and gentlemen. I'm talking about literally social mobility, which has nothing to do with economics. Not in the way that we look at it anyway. The idea of, I got to get ahead, you know, more than my neighbor. No, that's not real social mobility. Real social mobility deals with the communication factor between me and my neighbor and my neighbor's neighbor and my neighbor's neighbor's neighbors and the neighbors all around me. That's real social mobility. So when I fall sick, I know I have the social network, which has nothing to do with the internet. Actually, it has to do with an internet, but the internet used to be within us. Now it's externalized. But when I fall sick, when I need help, my social mobility is measured in my means of being able to call on other people around me to help me out and their ability to help me. If the society lacks that mobility, that flexibility, you have a dead society. And the way that the economic landscape works, it makes us fight each other instead of join with each other. And this is the problem. Now, of course, if you're any type of a thinking person, you're going to put together what I just said right there And you're going to contrast it with how I started this, and you're going to say, well, wait a minute. You seem to be dividing us more so than bringing us together. One of the major issues that this country, this society has is its inability to look at the truth and to get to the root of what has caused the problems which they're facing. And part of that is because this is not a revolutionary society. It has never been a revolutionary society. Gerald Horn, he writes convincingly of this. He talks convincingly of this, that this society is not revolutionary. Even in 1776, it wasn't revolutionary. The idea of the radical is to get to the root of a problem, to take it out and to put something new in it where that root used to be. And we discourage that. We frown upon that. If you are a radical, there's something wrong with you. Why, here's the problem. In nature, it is natural for a body to have radicals. A radical, by scientific definition, changes the body, sometime for the better, sometime for the worse. But the radical, the majority job of the radical, is to change the cell for aging. Now, of course, some of us want to live forever, but the majority of us do not want to live forever. Everything has its day. Everything has its night. Everything has its spring, its summer, its autumn, and its winter. That's the cycle of life. And when you are in a nation, in a country, particularly a country, because a country can be several nations put together. When you're in a country, it is the job of radical thought to evolve that country into its most mature place. And hopefully, the radical thought progresses enough so where the country can stay at that mature place for an extended period of time. A tree is a great example of a country being molded and changed by radical thought. Large trees take time to grow, but once when they grow to their limit, they can stay that way for millennia. And then they die. And then the shell usually is left there for a long time, and it takes a while even for them to die. And then, boom, process starts all over again. The United States has been trying to avert this pattern. They've been trying to break off of the natural cycle. And when you do that, you cause cancers to arise. And those cancers, if you don't root them out, cancers rarely have anything to do with radicals. There's an anti-ager which is introduced to the body, which often causes cancer. Some of them are caused, as you know, by diseases, by weaknesses in genetic structure, by foreign particles. But the radical's job, if you don't get those cancers out, then they will cost the body its life. And we in this country, because this country is so vehemently against radical thought and tradition, they have set themselves up to have multiple cancers spring up. And I don't know if you can root them out. One of the greatest concepts that I'm surprised more people haven't picked up from the shock doctrine was the idea of wiping the mind. Wiping the mind, breaking the mind. This is something that they've been doing, and entertainment does a good job of breaking people's mind from reality. And you almost, in order to make consumers who are not conscious of what they're consuming and what happens when they consume that much, you have to break the mind and the personality. This is something that John Taylor Gatto talked about. Now, I don't want to give people the idea that I'm some well-read person, because I work for a living, so I don't have time to read as much as I'd like to read. But I do want you to understand, these concepts are present in society. And especially the concept of wiping a person's mind. There's this book called Born to Buy, which is a book I read years ago, but, excuse me, didn't even read it all. I just kind of, I read the first two chapters, was like, okay, this is good, and then I kind of skimmed the rest of it. I was actually in college at the time, so it was kind of a book that I didn't need to read for class, so just skimmed through the rest of it, but It's a frightening book, because what it basically argues is that marketers, using psychologists and sometimes sociologists as partners, are creating systems of entertainment which addict children, not adults, children, to certain products and product lines for life. And this has been going on for the last 20-30 years. They've been studying and researching, you know, doing it for probably since the 50s. That's at least when they'll admit to it. But it's definitely been a means of social programming since the 80s. So in other words, millennials, this is your generation. But think about this. If they're doing this with something as benign as consumer products, soda, McDonald's, Burger King, things like that, do you maybe think they do it with politics too? If you don't, go back and watch some of your old cartoons. I'm talking about from the 80s. And some of them use the word radical. I remember this as a kid. They would use the word radical as something cool, as something with it, as something hip, as something modern, something to be with. But that ain't what radical meant. And that ain't the whole concept of radical, but it diffuses the idea of radical. They've also, you want a better case of that. Check out what they did with communism and socialism. Now, all of you, when you hear those words, you automatically say, ugh, disgusting. Where'd you get that from? Where'd you hear it from? How about the television? How many of you have actually read any books on socialism or communism? None of you. And if you have, it's all been negative. Because, see, we aren't encouraged to actually form opinions in this country. We're not encouraged to read books to analyze those books, those theories. We are told that these are bad. I'm not saying they're bad or good, even though I like socialism myself, but I'm not saying anything about that. What I'm saying is, if they're going to program you to buy stuff that you don't need, you better believe they're going to program you to believe stuff you don't want to believe. It is in their best interest. If, for instance, you for a moment thought that a third party, which could actually do the work that you needed to build up your community, if you thought that that party had a chance in this system, would you vote for them? Of course you would. But most of us are in the are stuck in the mentality of it's a two-party system. It's a two-party state. If you go outside those two parties, then the other party wins, and your team takes a loss because you had to try to be independent. You had to try to exercise a democratic vote that was outside of the norm. That ain't democracy. That's authoritarianism. Ain't nowhere near democracy. We got to start seeing this stuff. We got to start seeing this stuff. And this kind of goes back to what I started out talking about. You see, because if our minds are wiped enough where we can't make a political assessment of our own lives, then we're going to allow some other stuff to happen to other people, and we're going to rationalize it based on someone else's concept of what they need you to believe and what they need me to believe about those other people. And so therefore, when the whirlwind comes through to the good people who sat by and did nothing, they're looking around and saying, "What the heck? Why am I reaping these benefits? I've done nothing to deserve this horrible treatment." When in fact, the mere reality of you ignoring what was going on and then benefiting, even if it was just from getting a job, while these other people were getting horribly mistreated, having that happen, that opens up the door to karma. And that's why I'm watching all of this, and I'm wondering, truthfully wondering, if these folks really do get that this is a play on karma. And if the original sin is not corrected, things are not going to get better. I don't think things are going to get better even if they were to correct it tomorrow. Got to let that energy play out. But I think we'd all be in a better position if it was taken care of tomorrow. But that's why I keep talking about it. Because everyone now is concerned about their own crew, their own group. And they are not trying to fix the problem. And because they're not trying to fix the problem is going nowhere. We have no more excuses now, ladies and gentlemen. We have none. 25 years ago, 30 years ago, we could say, well, we really don't have the information. You know, it was harder to get the information. You had to actually go and do some work to find the information. Got to go to the library, read a bunch of magazines, read a bunch of newspapers. You had to seek out alternative newspapers, alternative magazines. That's what you had to do. You wanted to know some alternative news, you needed to seek out a store which sold videos. Videos, not DVDs, videos from alternative news sources. You had to seek out radio programming, which was actually a little bit more easier than today because, you know, things aren't on the radio, but you had to seek out radio programming, which was on the fringe. It was hidden in the shadows. You had to look for it, but it was there. Took a little bit more effort 25, 30 years ago. It did. Honestly, it took a little bit more effort. But today we have no excuse. None. We have the books, and we can get them easily, mostly through Amazon. We have the news sites, literally news sites. We have the podcasts. Unfortunately, some of the great broadcasters of that era are either now dead or retired. We have it. We have to now use the information that we got. We do. And it's not going to be enough to just fight one individual battle. You're now going to have to pick up the torch of all of them. Colonialism is collapsing. Capitalism is collapsing. Where do we go from here? That is the question. Where do we go from here? All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'll see you on the other side. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for joining me today, for being here with me. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, let me know. As I said, and I will definitely keep this pledge to you, that I will be putting together a format for this show, and sometime in the next 3 to 4, middle of the summer, so 3 to 6 months, I'll be definitely unveiling that. So, you know, stay tuned, and thank you very much for listening. Have a great one. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone.